Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and to discuss in technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club's website. A link can be found on the front page of our website in orange colored type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, you can type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. Also have an Echo Link node available for use. Just point your Echo Link application to node kc2rc-r. Net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate. Although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club, and as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your first name, your call sign, whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment, and when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or by using our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. Now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
Roy, good evening, everybody out there. Roy, I'm going to ask for an early, what you call it, exit. I'm going to get a phone call around 10 I need to take, and I'm getting up really early tomorrow, but I'm here now, so let's get on with the net. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Look, Bob, if you need to leave, you need to leave. I understand. I appreciate your participation with me in this technical net. But if real life invades, it takes precedent, and I understand that. So I just want to make sure you understand that I do appreciate the time that you do spend with us here on the technical net. Well, with that in mind, I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy. And if you're out there and you have a question or a comment or a topic, please hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign. Well, it looks like that 10 o'clock curfew isn't going to be that much of a problem tonight, unless people show up a little bit late, which sometimes that happens. Sometimes I have little stories of what happened previous week or some technical news. Unfortunately, nothing springs to mind tonight. It's been rather quiet, you know, with Labor Day weekend the previous week. And I think people are still kind of getting used to the fact that it's the fall. Well, let's try once again. I am AC2GS, and my name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m. We go for as long as someone has a question or a topic of discussion, and as short as possibly today. So if you're out there and you have a question, or you have a topic, or you have a comment, you discovered something you'd like to share with us about amateur radio, you found a new mode that excites you and you want to share it with people, what have you. If you're out there and you have something to add to the mix of the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, hit that push-to-talk button, give us your first name and your call sign.
Alpha Delta 2 Delta Uniform, Alex.
Hello, Alex. How are you this fine evening? Do you have any questions or comments for today?
Yeah, what do you do on DMR besides Worldwide Talk Group 91? Like, what else is interesting on the digital mode? In that I have DMR hooked up, I have the Anytone handheld radio, I have a repeater. I don't really know what to do, though. 82 to you.
Okay, that's a good question as any. As we speak, I have hooked up something called QuadNet. QuadNet has different types of nets that meet. Usually, Wednesday nights at 9 p.m., they have a astronomy net. I think 10 o'clock, if you're familiar with the podcast Ham Nation, they have a Ham Nation, post-Ham Nation net. And so I log into, I believe it's Brandmeister Talk Group 31012. It's kind of erratic, unfortunately. Sometimes I pick up these nets, but sometimes for some reason or other, they might not be linked every single week, and the links kind of have to be maintained. So right now, although I should be recording the astronomy net for a friend of mine, I'm not getting any signal. But QuadNet, theoretically, is one of them. You probably should just go to Brandmeister and do a search for the different talk groups and see if there's some title for a talk group that interests you. You know, make it a static talk group for a couple of days. Listen to it and make your decision and then move on to another. Now, some people make multiple static talk groups and they scan through them. That can get a little bit kind of dizzy.
The Brandmeister site is the best place that aggregates whatever schedule of nets.
Well, yeah, for DMR, there are different backbones for each of the technologies, unfortunately. So there are D-Star servers and there are Fusion servers. And usually a lot of the standard initial Pi-Star hotspots can only get into one group depending upon what kind of a radio you're interfacing it. If you're interfacing the Pi-Star with a D-Star radio, you can get D-Star. If you are using a Fusion, I think you're able to cross over to DMR, and DMR lets you cross over to Fusion. But for a DMR, Brandmeister has the largest collection that I'm aware of talk groups. There are other servers out there, and you don't necessarily have to connect your hotspot or BlueDV to Brandmeister. There are alternative servers that have a much smaller number of talk groups. Apparently, the QuadNet seems to be slightly active. I just saw it register, so have their net a little bit later than scheduled. Brandmeister is probably, especially for DMR, if you'll find the most talk groups. There are other servers that kind of collect the most active subset of Brandmeister talk groups, but this thing is to splash down in Brandmeister, just look for different titles for the talk groups, and that'll give you an indication of what they think they're about. They won't give you an indication of how active they are, unfortunately.
It's good to know. If you have time later, my second question would be, what logging software do you use, and what's the difference between the two main logging sites or logging contacts? 82 to you.
Well, yeah, things are very quiet tonight, so we can go to your number two question. Unfortunately, I don't have a great deal of experience. There are people who log every conversation they have. I tend to be the opposite. I think 20 years ago, it was a legal requirement. Then they dropped it entirely, so it's fully voluntary. I was running the club's 10-meter net this Sunday morning, came upon a gentleman who I've spoken to in the past from Arizona. when propagation was better. And he has an electronic logbook and could tell me exactly the last time we chatted together. He enters it in QRZ. Don't know if that's his primary logbook, but if you go into QRZ, and it's probably a good idea to get yourself an account if you don't have one, and put up a little biography. You know, if you want to be mysterious, so be it. I put up a bunch of pictures of my shack and my little story of setting it up, and included my email address. So if people need to contact me, they can do so. I'm not concerned that I'll get spammed and such. So I'm not that familiar. There's lots of different logging software out there, and everyone seems to have their favorite. Primarily, most conversations I've heard about logging software are for different contests. So if you're interested in contesting, then logging software is important because you have to send in your logs to whatever agency is running the contest. I've never really been a big contester. For some odd reason, it's kind of like playing tag to me. And the last time I did that, I was about 7 years old. So I prefer rag chewing and such. And so, you know, keeping a log isn't incredibly important to me. But if Bob has some experience with log software or anyone else out there, I'd love to hear about it. Yes, William, I guess.
Control, Alpha Charlie 2 Zulu Victor checking in to the TechNet. I heard you going on about logging software. I have no idea about that at all. I just want to say hi, let you know I'm here.
Okay, good to have you aboard, William. You broke up a little bit at the beginning, but later on, it was a nice solid copy. Yeah, so unfortunately, Alex, I wish I could give you details. You know, all you have to do is Google, and you'll be inundated with different types of log software. You probably, if you're interested in contests and such, should get the ARRL's, I forget what they call it. I have it. It's the logbook. It's the worldwide logbook. It basically allows you to download your contacts into a formatted type of a file and then sign them with your authenticated ID so that no one could imitate your entries. And that's usually good for ARRL-based contests.
Good to know. Thank you. ADT to you.
BB.
Yes, Bob?
I'm just going to mention NetLogger. Maybe that's not the same thing. That's all I know. But I think you all, every guest might know about that already. Maybe that's different. But that's what, you know, that's what the club uses for field day and such things. Back to you.
Okay, that certainly is a software that's used for our field day, and I believe that under some manner the FusionNet utilizes that software. I'm not quite sure what for, but you know, for the weekly nets, they log into that that program.
Yes, I believe they do. They MVP here. I haven't been on the FusionNet in a few months because I have a gig now that conflicts with it, but they were using it then, and I assume they still are. Back to you.
Yeah, I based on about a month ago, I checked out they now record and publish on YouTube. So if you miss them and you want to listen to them, you can go. They now have a YouTube channel. But getting back to you, Alex, I guess we kind of exhausted it. You know, I mean, all you do is Google it and you'll have a laundry list. And based upon the amount of entries, you'll get a good idea of what the popular softwares are and lesser softwares. And again, so a lot of times these softwares differentiate themselves in being free versus being commercial, being very flexible, versus being very simple and inflexible, and others that have little modules built into them that plug in so that you can format the information for different types of contests that run throughout the year. Okay, well, once again, I am AC2GS, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So once again, if anyone out there has any questions or topics for tonight or comments, please feel free. Hit that push-to-talk button and let us hear them.
Good evening, Roy. This is Dave.
Oh, Max, yeah, I see you on the Echo Link. I hope all is well.
Things are good. I'm just on Echo Link finishing some stuff up. Can't get to the radio right now. But to comment on the loggers, I am going old school. I just have a notebook and pen. It actually is working out pretty well because not always do I have the right software running, right laptop, or whatever. You know what I mean? But I did use NetLogger a couple of times, but I thought that was more like if somebody's running a net, you got to register the net, and then you can actually capture, but I haven't really been capturing any contacts that are not part of that logger. But pen and paper.
Okay, well, that certainly is the old-fashioned type. You know, there's people just kind of get themselves one of those marble notebooks that they had in school and scribble away if you want to be fancy-schmancy. Places like the ARRL sells logbooks where there's proper lining for different types of information. I'm sure there's lots of people who still use the good old-fashioned logbook and others that look into QRZ. Only QRZ, and I would tend to agree with you. I never really looked at it, but in listening, the way that the FusionNet seems to use it is in a way to kind of get a sense of who's logged on and you know who's listening to the net. So it's one of those log software that's optimized for network capability as opposed to the contest types where you can package things up into specifically formatted types, categories, and just spit it out to the places that are looking for that data in that form for a given contest. So, yeah, it jives with me. I commend you in your obsessiveness that you keep logs. I so often think to myself, gee, I probably should, but I never get around to it. I do scribble a lot of notes of a lot of things. Like every one of these nets has a virtual page on an application on my iPad.
Well, I don't keep particularly amazing logs. Mostly what I actually end up talking to on net, not necessarily everybody who gets on the net, but that I connect with. It also helps me remember the call sign with them. Otherwise, I will. I haven't gotten very good at catching the call signs. Just iPad idea is kind of interesting because in an iOS environment, you kind of go across multiple devices. And just when this conversation's done, I have a very simple question that I hope answer.
Well, I think we kind of beat this particular dead horse. I just want to add that, when I first started running nets, I used a notebook and generated lots and lots and lots and lots of pages, and it became kind of cumbersome of do I store them, do I throw them away? So I found there's at least a few note-keeping applications in iPads, and I have different size iPads. Depending upon the amount of information, I pull out different size iPads. Tonight, it's my mini iPad. When the general meeting is occurring, it's my 12-inch iPad. So the sizes change, and thankfully the applications are interoperable, so the same pages will show up on all sizes of my iPads. So for the time being, it seems to work out well, for my purposes at least. I have a good record, and I can store them without it taking up much of any space. Yes, William. Yes, William.
I'm definitely with Max on the notebook thing because I just wanted to give my two cents here. I keep these marble notebooks like you're talking about. I have a red one right now. And I like scribbling. I mean, typing is annoying to me, and I like scribbling, but I do find it very difficult to be able to actually get the call signs written down properly. It's a real memory task that just when somebody says their call sign really fast, you get little parts of it and where they're from, and so when you're doing net control operator, it's really, like, sometimes embarrassing to screw up so bad. But do you have problems like that, Roy?
Yes, I do. But after a few years of doing it, I seem to have built up a capacity to... also, a lot of times I will recognize a person's voice. So even if they garble the call sign or they say it very, very fast, I can still restore the data. Sometimes people sound like other people, and then it gets confusing. You know, things like the Limark technical net, a lot of different people with a lot of different call signs, and it's kind of difficult to keep them all straight. So I agree with you. If I had to use a keyboard, I probably the iPad, but iPads have little pencils. So I scribble with my pencil all the time. So I would agree. Although, you know, I type, but just for the sake of scratching out notes, I much prefer using an iPad with a pencil, with an electronic pencil, obviously.
What you mean about that? I haven't got into that. I got one for my wife, and immediately we lost a tip for it, and then I found out I had to buy new ones. What a shock. You know, you buy something and it doesn't work because you lost the stupid little part that they then charge you more money for. Anyway, we got it working again, and she's very happy with it. But I think the iPad sounds like a pretty interesting tool to use for these type of things. Does it do scribble-to-text recognition?
Theoretically, it does, but whoever designed it, not design it with amateur radio operators in mind. So it will completely garble call signs. It will try to make normal sense of people's call signs. It has no conception of what a call sign is. It'll try to make it a word.
That doesn't work so well, but what I do find does work is that the voice translation thing seems to be getting much, much better. One of the interesting things I found out is when I say something into the phone and it types it out and gets it wrong, if I'm just quiet and wait, it then figures it out again, and then it figures it out correctly. And it's starting to be able, if I say period, it actually does a period, and then I tried comma, it does comma. So, I mean, it's really amazing the technology of the voice to text. And maybe that would work also on the radio. I don't know. But we'll have to see, because that's what I'm interested in, getting some garbly ham radio transmission, voice to text, and then back through, you know, Siri telling me what it actually says. But how far in the future is that?
I would think it's going to take a while, because it's, for the most part, in my experience, of voice to text, requires reasonably good fidelity and relatively low background noise. If you're doing period and comma and such, that's kind of hardwired, you could do it with a thick accent, and my guess would be the algorithms would correct. But if you're doing words fast and there's a lot of background noise, you'll have problems. You might get away with it on FM because the fidelity is much better. The full capture has a relatively little noise. But on a single sideband, lots of luck. It's going to require probably 10, 20 plus years of AI algorithms and computational crunching where they can resynthesize voices with a relatively loud, noisy background. But again, there are AI software, experimental. I signed up with Adobe. They're beta testing something. But that's not real time. So you can feed the recording and they'll clean up the audio. But what you would need for practical use for AMs would be real time artificial intelligence reconstructing words and such. And I don't think the algorithms and the computers are quite ready for something like that yet. But they will, I'm sure.
I just just took everything you just said and I put that into a text message. And now I'm talking to you on the radio, and it's actually translating what I'm saying directly as I'm talking to you. So from the original text message, all that it really got was, hold on, let me just check it out. Get a computer. Those are the words that it came out with. Where and get a computer. Out of everything that you said, the voice to text from ham radio into my phone came out with just four words.
Oh, well, I'm sure it could have done better under tighter control circumstances, what have you. I've played with a voice to text for at least 15 years. Nuance was a big company that made all kinds of pieces of software, and I think they were finally just bought up by Microsoft. So all those things are going to go away, at least as commercial pieces of software. They'll you know, absorb some of it for the operating system and maybe improve its ability to do voice to text as time goes on. You know, artificial intelligence is kind of the big phrase. A lot of software companies are tacking AI as part of the name of their latest version of their software. And it's been especially useful, at least for me, in graphics and such. It can take a really rotten VCR video capture of a movie and make it look decent in 720, which is amazing to me still to this day. It doesn't require a great deal of processing time to do it either. It doesn't do it instantaneously, but it does it in a reasonable amount of time. So there's going to be a lot of AI supplemented software that's going to improve the ability to do things. It'll be synthesized, and you know, the data, if you don't have the data, you can't kind of reconstruct your own data from being lost. But artificial intelligence can look at your data and match it with something it knows about. And so it might not be 100% reality. These AI devices guess things. So they guess them right. Sometimes they guess them wrong.
I get you on the AI. I'd like to know the name of the software that you're talking about that converts VCR images to 720. You know, because I have a lot of that kind of stuff, and I'm playing around with things, and I'm interested if you have any real information about what works.
Well, I have to look it up because I'm not really great with program names. I'll look it up after the net, unless it pops into my head, and I'll email it to you.
That's 5x5. Thank you so much, because I've been playing around with it, and I'm really interested to find out what's up there. I have another program, and so I'll email you back with that information if it's different. We'll see and compare notes.
Okay, I Googled it as best I could. It's Topaz Labs. It's called Video Enhance AI. It does a beautiful job, at least the ones that I've tried it. It kind of bulks up the program size, obviously, because it's adding a lot of extra definition to the MP4 file, and you know, slow down some decoding video accelerating software and such. But look up topazlabs.com, and it's called Video Enhance AI.
What I got, and I'm just—it seems to be pretty darn good. I'm really impressed with the results so far. But I'm just reaching out because I know that there's got to be better stuff. I am also trying out what happens within the AI in the timeline of the Blackmagic editor. And so that's a whole new exploration for me. I found the manual online, and that's only 1,000 pages long.
Yeah, by the way, AC2GS. This last Sunday night, there was a discussion about DaVinci Resolve, which was made by Blackmagic. It's, I cautioned the gentleman who was very excited. He even paid for the full software. A good significant portion of the software is available for free. free, but I think he paid the $198 or so to unlock extra modules, audio modules, and other modules. But it, to me, it does have a degree of a steep learning curve. These are not designed to be relatively simple, you know, pieces of software that, you know, you hit stop and go and things like that. You have to kind of understand how it's designed to be used. But if you put in the time, you can do professional work because it's a professional piece of software.
I like it. It's a large learning curve and it's a big bump out there. I've been using 17 for a while with just some scratch projects, and then they've introduced 18, which changes everything. So I think if you started out on 18 without knowing anything, you might be better off than me with all my encumbrance from iMovie and all this stuff from over the years.
Yeah, it sort of depends, you know, because all these software, although their purposes are very similar, their origins usually started off someplace else, and they kind of grew into a whole functioning piece of software, and the path that they developed from is kind of baked into a lot of these things. And as far as DaVinci Resolve, it was my understanding that way, way, way back at the beginning, it was mostly a movie color adjusting piece of software, because matching colors and such is very important in videos. You know, if you have different stock, or even if you have electronic cameras and such, different lighting conditions, give you different colors, and so you want to have better control. So they started as a color matching control piece of software, and then slowly kind of took over other aspects in the video field until it was a kind of one service video professional server type of software. So I could understand if you sometimes it's like learning the wrong language. You know, if you learn a language that's somewhat similar but different, a lot of times it's very difficult to pick up the next one. You keep falling back to the previous one. So I could understand that.
I think it's interesting that you explained it like that, because now I understand a little bit more about the way that program has been originally designed. Because one of the features of that program that I'm interested in being able to pry out is this, they have this 3D color space situation where you can take a video that's like currently playing back and basically convert it into a 3D space, which has colors in different directions within a 3D space that are all like blobbing and changing around as the video plays back. And then you can like apply different filters to different levels of that field and then collapse it all back together and see the output. So I got a demo of that one day at NAB from some guy that really knew what to do. And I had never been able to recreate anything like that, but I know it's probably in their software.
Well, yeah, and again, it kind of demonstrates that at its original core, it was a color correction software. So they have a lot of finesse under the hood, if you're so inclined. You know, you go to, they bought another company's, it might be called Fusion, audio module. So that company was purely working on manipulating sound. So I'm not really that familiar of how interesting they might have developed, but I know I've looked at something called Isotope RX, I think it's up to 10 now, where you can kind of disassemble sounds and kind of give you a 3D representation, and it's able to heal sounds, extract voice from music, extract music from voice, and do all kinds of spectral manipulations on the audio field that DaVinci Resolve is able to do in the color chemistries portion of motion videos.
Victor, yeah, I think that what you just said really clears up some other things, because within the Resolve suite, you deal with Fusion as the audio engine, you know, within the timeline. And so there's all these Fusion effects that you can export and bring back in and stuff like that. So the idea that they must have bought Fusion and grafted it into the timeline makes total sense. And I also love the concept of what you're saying, but the colorizing, because that also makes sense, because if you shot some scene and the sky turned white that was blue, you would want to take all of those high Luma pixels and just convert them to blue and then slap it back down into the picture. And I think that basically explains what the guy showed me and how the software works. So I thank you for both of those revelations.
Well, you're welcome, William. I mean, like I usually discuss tools, you know, I say a hammer can build a house or it could split the skull of your neighbor. You know, these are all just tools, and you could use them for good or you can use them for evil. And if you pay attention to some people who kind of really look at color balance when they review a film, they will actually get into the nitty-gritty of whether or not they like the color balance. There are some directors who go for these very dark tones, these muddy colors. In the old days, they did it through chemistry. There was a bleach that they used to bleach the dyes, give it a particular patiche, and now electronically, it's anything you want it to be. So you can do amazing things, and you can do terrible things with adjusting the color of a movie.
Yeah, you can. And, you know, interestingly enough, the real deal is that even though that the software for DaVinci Resolve is free, the control surfaces that are required to adjust the color are extremely expensive. They can get up into the thousands of dollars for the control surface to adjust the color within DaVinci Resolve. So, you know, to their benefit, it's great to give away the software for free, because if you ever really want to do that color adjustment, you're going to start buying these control panels, and they cost a lot of money.
AC2GS. Yeah, one of the guys I was talking to Sunday night on the technical net on Limark owns one of those less expensive control surfaces, and I think it was on sale on top of that. So yeah, it still probably cost him a couple thousand dollars, I mean, for something that's ultimately a very glorified keyboard. I think theoretically it would be a big pain in the backside. You could probably simulate the settings using keyboards and software sliders and such. What the control panels offer you more than anything, I get the feeling, is convenience, the ease of use. That if you're doing this for a living and your time is money, to get those things dialed in quickly can save you thousands of dollars. It's probably, to one degree or another, doable, because you'll see control devices for all kinds of things. There's a couple of companies sell somewhat sophisticated, I think it's $400, control devices to operate things like Adobe Premiere and Photoshop and such. And the way that they seem to sell it is there's nothing that you can't do without their keyboard, but it just makes it a little bit more efficient and it runs a little faster.
A cheap Shuttle Pro for $60, and I know that the ones that cost $100 are better, but I figured I'm going to probably buy two eventually, so I bought the $60 one first to see how much I hated it, and then we'll see about the next one later. But I think these control surfaces are great, and lucky that guy got that for $2,000, because those things are going for $27,000.
Well, I think we're kind of talking apples and oranges. He probably had kind of the entry-level control surface, you know, something that basically looks a little bit, you know, about the size of a desk blotter with a couple of balls and mostly buttons and a couple of sliders, whereas there are things that take up half of a room. I've seen, you know, at the bottom of Blackmagic's website, where they show you some of their surfaces. And it looks like a regular professional studio. There's a lot of of area covered, and a lot of those round ball-like controllers for 3D stuff and sliding levers and dials and knobs. And I don't know. I would probably end up getting confused of what the hell does what.
Desire is there. You figure it out. Anyway, I found the entry-level piece was about $1,750. So if he got something for $2,000, he must have got like a mid-range piece on sale. So, you know, it's got to be a lot of fun to be able to actually control it. And after you spend $2,000 on something, I'm sure you feel like, oh, I better learn how to use this.
Yeah, I would agree. It would be a terrible travesty if you throw that money away and you just decide that it wasn't quite for you. You know, I mean, one of the other features is since he bought the hardware, he got the key to open up the rest of the software. So he didn't have to spend the extra $200. He got the full blown software because it was thrown in with the hardware.
$100 on $2,000. That's a nice tip. Oh, hey, maybe we'll go back to the tech debt. I don't know. You need to do the call again?
Well, I think Max said that he had a question or something to say. So, Max, if you have a question for tonight, this would be a perfectly good time.
Hey, guys. This is DD2VA. Just was curious. I was in San Diego trying to find some folks to talk to because I know that the West Coast has a bigger amateur radio community. And then I ran into a kind of a conundrum. How do I find the internet? So I was in a scanning function on handheld. And I didn't really hit anything. So I had to whip out the laptop with Cube SDR. And then that way I was able to find until every there is Papa the idea that it was. And there I heard some interesting conversation actually reading one. In order to do that, I had to computer use any software. I had to then go on the internet, look up the computer frequencies and the alt tone. So it wasn't easy. I was curious, how do you guys go about finding folks?
It sort of depends. I kind of just open up my PAN adapter. You know, it was very nice having an SDR because you know you can open up the UHF and VHF band. You can look to see if there's any activity and click to the active site and figure out what's going on. To listen, you don't need to know a PL tone. But if you want to transmit to them, then you have to figure out the PL tone. Sometimes they will transmit the PL tone back at people, and you can detect it. Other times, you just have to, unfortunately, look it up. I mean, getting back to your earlier comment of doing it old school, version would be either a handbook. The ARRL and other companies make these handbooks. There's little versions of it that can be kept rather, you know, in a satchel or what have you, and you pull it out and you come through the geographic area and it gives you frequencies and PL tones and all kinds of things. The downside with either the book form or the repeater list that are available if you have internet access is, again, they don't really tell you about the activity. So there's no indication whether this repeater is used frequently or infrequently or not at all. And when people shut down their repeaters, they don't usually notify anyone. And so dead repeaters remain in repeater books for decades. So it's not a perfect system, but having a little repeater handbook, occasionally if you're a member of the ARRL, a lot of times they offer free books to people renewing their membership. And usually one of them is the handbook. So I think it's certainly worth the price, which is free.
The handbook is a good tip. I didn't think about that, especially if there's it's a little smaller than regular big book. So a little bit about the conversation. What was fascinating is that when I started looking up this Papa 3 reader, apparently you have the Papa Network has, I think, like 7 theaters connected to each
other, so I'm kind of curious, what do you think of their connected? But what I was hearing is different amateur operators tracking a launch of a satellite from Vandenberg Air Force Base. This was a Starlink, SpaceX Starlink satellite launch. Pretty fascinating. So the folks who were pretty close to the base that we talked about seeing the launch, and then the other folks were tracking it over the Pacific, over the water, more or less in San Diego and over the border with Mexico, and kind of as it was going up and the separation features. It's pretty cool to see the community tracking that. It was very exciting. And after that, I got when I finally got my PL tone straightened out, I got to chat with one of those folks who was on later on. It's pretty exciting.
Ah, that's very good. The West Coast has much more activity. They have more licensed amateur radio operators. You can kind of tell by how far they are into the alphabet. You know, I think they filled up the KD, are they sixes? I think they're KD six. A decade ago. I don't even remember where they are, but they're long past KDs and KEs and KFs and KGs. And they have more active hams there. We were talking in this past general meeting about mesh network, where people are using Wi-Fi frequencies to develop mesh networks of basically amateur radio operators, but existing on their own little mesh network. That's a real thing on the West Coast. On the East Coast, people try and get it done, but you need a particular number and density because Wi-Fi transmissions, even highly focused with high-gain antennas, kind of don't go quite that far. So, the Papa Network is a great network. Every Friday night at 10 o'clock local, I listen to a friend of mine, is the net control operator for the Papa Antenna Technical Net. And they have a bunch of different gateways. Echolink, if you look up Papa on Echolink, there's a link for the Papa network. And they use a whole bunch of different technologies. Internet linking is probably their major one, but there are some cases for other reasons that they might use something like 900 megahertz, which is still in the amateur radio band, to link one repeater to another. There are local repeaters that have similar links, not Papa does. Limark has a voter system where it'll figure out the best radio to pick up your signal, the strongest signal, and then it will run either an internet link or a 900 megahertz type of a link to the main repeater sets. So linked repeaters, either through the internet, through proprietary modes, or IRLP is a good broad protocol that links separate disparate repeaters to each other and that are addressable and changeable.
This is KDVA. That's actually interesting. So it's I figured some of it could be internet connected, but I was hoping it was a little bit more interesting than that. But the 900 megahertz connection, that's pretty interesting because the Papa 3 repeater that I connected to was on the 446 megahertz frequency, so that was a station meter connection. So I figured that wouldn't reach to each other if they were just retransmitting the same thing. But 900 megahertz thing is interesting. I wonder what the distance on that would be. Do you have an idea how spaced out these repeaters would have to be?
Well, it sort of depends upon how high and if there's any obstructions. If you can get it really high, you can, because all these high near gigahertz frequencies are point to point. They're not, you're not using any kind of other form of propagation. So then you get what's basically free path attenuation loss. As the frequency gets higher, the signal attenuates. So it's a function of the topology and the amount of power that you're transmitting. I wouldn't know specifically, judging from the fact that with Limark, their two main repeaters. The Plainview in the Glen Oaks is on a, I believe, a 900 megahertz link. So that's probably a distance, I would think, of about 15 to 20 miles.
That is not an insignificant distance. You're right, directionality and how high it is, that matters. Do you think they use it point-to-point? Do they use directional antennas or the satellites? Like, what do you think they're using in order to point to point lasers?
I would assume that they're using Yagis. They don't cost that much. You don't really need to have, you know, horns and such. That's really for the full microwave. You can still build reasonably efficient, high-gain Yagis that should be able to do the job.
That sounds pretty cool. That was a good experience, and it was interesting to see a network of something like 15 to 16 computers, and thanks for the echo link. I might join that. It was really cool to hear satellite launches. I'm very interested in space, but that was really cool to hear. That's what I was kind of curious about, because I had a little bit of a challenge bringing contacts and then connecting those interesting. I just wonder how everybody else does it. That's pretty much it. So I appreciate it. This is CDTEA.
AC2GS. Well, you're welcome, Max. But there's all kinds of other things. A lot of repeaters are linked through Apple and Android applications. I discovered how Papa Network are very nice guys. They're legit people. On the West Coast, there are kind of outlaw repeaters, if you will. Remember, I used some app and I just dialed in West Coast, and I noticed one repeater had more people listening to it, and so I was curious and I tuned in. I don't remember which it was, but they were a foul-mouthed group of creepy people. I mean, I still remember some poor kid from some southern state got on through Echolink, and because he was from Echolink and not locally, they just insulted him until he finally broke the connection. And a lot of talk about drugs and alcohol and all kinds of terrible things. I don't think you'll ever hear that stuff from the Papa Network repeaters. But there are some repeaters down on the West Coast that are just kind of, I don't know why the FCC lets them get away with some of this stuff.
What's funny, I feel like the ARRL has been doing more in terms of enforcement and tracking people down than FCC has been, these stories I'm hearing. But I'm sure there's a bunch of people who are doing exactly buy a radio and go for it, right? Ball Fangs is what, $50? See with inflation? Get and go.
I mean, that certainly is part of the problem, and that was the reason why at one point you saw these articles about how you wouldn't be able to get a Baofeng anymore because the FCC was tired of hearing about how, you know, they're selling them in Walmart and, you know, you don't need a license, you don't need anything. For the most part, a lot of the guys kind of doing wacky things were properly licensed. They had the guys in the West Coast repeaters all had legitimate call signs, and there are on HF places and times that will go down in history. When I first got licensed 11 years ago, it was I think it was 14.310. And the biggest group of juvenile delinquents who were cashing their Social Security checks, guys in retired detectives, therapists, and they were just yelling and screaming and insulting people all over the place. It took the FCC a good 6 or 7 years before they fined enough of them to kill that. And then other people moved over to another infamous frequency, 7.100, and tried to kind of pull the same nonsense. So there are guys out there with a license and with a real paying professional job, and you put a microphone in front of them and they go wacky.
There are always a few individuals out there, that's true, but for the most part, I've heard some conversations get a little bit more heated, especially political stuff, but nothing that cross beyond the pale or anything close to that. Yeah, that's pretty much it, Roy. I don't have any other technical things. Last I played with HF was that hamstick that I reached for Sunday net a while ago on, and I haven't Sunday, but I plan to play around with that at some point. I don't know, someday. You know how it goes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope you come back. This last Sunday, we had a gentleman who used to be a semi-regular from Arizona, a guy named Randy. It's something like KK7TV. We're finally breaking out of the metropolitan area.
No, that's really good to hear. Next time I'm going to try to use hamstick as the way to get them my other antenna away from the house, but do need to do a little bit of work there. Looking forward to it. It's to have some goals, as I say, in the space, and then I'll figure out if my problems are mostly antennas or also a little bit of the radio equipment and capability, kind of figuring out some of this. Looking forward to it, though. On that note, I am going to start wrapping up and to bed. This was a pleasure chatting with you, Roy, and I think it was Bob, I think it was. Memory sucks. But it was a pleasure. Have a good night. I really appreciate it. And 73.
Thank you. 73 to you. Yeah, we have Alex. We have William, KD2ZV. We of course, have our friend Bob, KD2NVB here. Well, once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone out there has any questions or comments, we'll listen for them. If not, we'll move on to our puzzler for the night, which is an illustrated one. So I hope the people out there listening will pull up their copy of the puzzle, and so that when we play it, they'll have an idea what I'm talking about. But if anyone out there has any other questions of technical nature or topics of discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk button.
NVB.
Yes, Bob.
I'm going to check out soon, 73s, but I may hang out for a minute. I don't know the tech puzzle. This one will know. So I may hang out and listen to the answer, but I may probably have to call my friend if he doesn't call me, and then I have to get ready and turn in. So kind of a 73, though. I may be listening, and I'm who knows, I might chime in. I'm going to try to catch the puzzle if it comes late up. Back to you, 73.
Okay, very good. 73, if I don't hear you again tonight. We'll try to go straight to the puzzle, because I don't know if there's anyone else listening. We can do questions after the puzzle, but let's go to the puzzle. So if there's anyone out there that is so inclined, it shouldn't be difficult. It's an illustration. It says, this figure shows a transformer balance. They stand for balanced to unbalanced devices. And it says the two balanced points are, and then there are four points in the illustration, very simple circuit design. So if anyone's out there who has access to their browser, pull up that illustration, wants to tell me which of the two points are part of the balanced input-outputs of a balun, hit that push to talk. Yes, William.
On the answer, I'm wondering if anybody else wants to have a shot at this.
Well, I'm not sure. We'll ask. I have this unfortunate feeling that everyone else is just, they put away their little microphone. Maybe they're listening to us, but I think they're done for the night. If there's anyone else who wants to play our little puzzler, please hit that push to talk.
2Z Victor. Okay. Points 1 and 2.
Okay. You're absolutely positively correct. Points 1 and 2 are the balanced one. If you kind of read schematics, it's not too difficult that 1 and 2 have a symmetry. And as we've mentioned before, the whole idea of a balanced circuit is a symmetrical circuit. Even if you don't understand what balanced is, if you simply know that a coaxial cable is an unbalanced transmission line, 3 and 4 have the schematic designation of a coax cable. So you already know that 3 and 4 are unbalanced, which kind of leaves you with 1 and 2. But you are absolutely positively correct, William. The answer is A, points 1 and 2.
And U is that I see a lot of these things as toroids. So would that be wrapped in a toroid core, or do you think that's wrapped on a ferrite linear core?
Most likely it would be on a toroidal core, because that's the most efficient to consolidate all of the magnetic fields, since it doesn't have an edge, so there's no loss, where a rod would have edges on either end of the ballon. So if you pop 100 ballons open, pretty much 100 of them are going to have a toroid as a ferrite.
Those coil indications represents some kind of winding on one-third of the toroid. Is that right, or are they cross-overlaid?
Well, there isn't that much. Usually they're cross, they're kind of wired close to each other. It's more efficient that way, but ultimately, since they're wound around the same toroid that's containing the magnetic field, they end up getting some degree of the current exchanged. But again, in most designs, you tend to have the primary and the secondary relatively close to each other. You're not going to have primary winding on one half of the toroid and the secondary winding on the other half.
Three windings here, so which one is which? There must be a tertiary winding too.
Yeah, they usually call those trifilar windings.
Well, that's really great. Well, my buddy said that he is going to come over here and help me put up my long wire reel antenna. So we will see how this works out, but I think it's going to be after October.
Well, I wish you good luck. You know, if you ever have any questions or such, you can always come here, or you can email me. Long wires can be incredibly useful. They're relatively simple. They're relatively easy to fix if they break. So, it's kind of difficult to go wrong with a long wire done well.
A center fit dipole. We'll see how that works out. Anyway, I really have to go on to supper. Thanks a lot for the TechNet, Roy. I really appreciate everything. 73. Thanks a lot. Unless you have something else, I'm ready to go.
No. 73. I appreciate your participation. We usually try and get it to at least an hour. It's an hour and 15 minutes. I will put a call out. If there's anyone out there listening who has a question or a comment to make before we wrap up for tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Okay, very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be October 10th. We don't have it on the first Wednesday for October. It's Monday, October 10th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting, and non-members wishing a general club meeting can email me, AC2GS, if you identify yourself, we will give you the proper link. Unfortunately, we cannot offer a link to anonymous requests. Although our meeting informally begins after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting begins at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter net every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater. Technical Net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. So sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 Upper Side Band, and we offer an audio stream of our Kings County Radio Club repeater on the Internet, as well as our 10-meter net. Just type your browser at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the hosts of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com. which offers archives of VisTechnicalNet, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Website hosting services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. Well, it's time to roll this all up, but we'll be back here September 28th. Do it all over again, and you're all welcome to join us. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight, and especially my co-host, Bob, KD2NVB. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So this is Roy, AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Stay safe, be well. We'll talk again down the line. AC2GS clear.